Hello, and welcome to New Books in Global Ethics and Politics. I'm John McMahon from the Graduate Center, City University of New York, one of your co-hosts for the channel. I just finished speaking with Nancy Fraser, Henry A. and Louise Lowe Professor of Political Science at the New School for Social Research in New York City, about her 2014 book, edited by Kate Nash, Transnationalizing the Public Sphere, which came out from Polity Press. In this really interesting and important and generative book, Fraser takes public sphere theory, particularly as it originates with Habermas and the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory tradition, and asks the question of what has changed since public sphere theory was originally being formulated that forces us to transnationalize it today, and then what would that transnationalization of public sphere theory entail, hewing very brilliantly to the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory method. Fraser interrogates this question in the opening essay, which is then followed by a number of commentaries from a diverse set of scholars with different theoretical backgrounds and disciplinary fields, and then followed by one final essay by Fraser responding to her critics. In the course of our conversation, Fraser and I talk about the background of public sphere theory, about changes in what she calls the post-national constellation that necessitate this transnationalization of the public sphere. We talk about normative legitimacy and political efficacy and their relation, touch somewhat on kind of recent developments with regards to the Greek referendum and other kind of contemporary issues that a critical theory of the transnational public sphere can address. I hope you enjoy the interview, and I urge you to go out and read the book. I'm now speaking with Nancy Fraser, who is Henry A. and Louise Lowe Professor of Political and Social Science at the New School for Social Research in New York City, and author of Transnationalizing the Public Sphere. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books in Global Ethics and Politics podcast.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be talking to you, and thanks for inviting me.
Yes, we're very happy to have you on. So before we get into the book itself, I was wondering if we could perhaps start by you giving us a little bit of background on your work and your research in critical theory and in public sphere theory, and perhaps especially how this book fits into the arc of your research in those areas.
Sure, absolutely. Well, Frankfurt School critical theory has always been an important influence and strand in my thinking, along with American pragmatism and some strands of French post-structuralism and feminist theory and democratic theory and so on. But within the Frankfurt School tradition, I've engaged especially with the thought of Jürgen Habermas, and it was his first book, actually. It's his habilitation thesis called Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere that piqued my interest in my curiosity about the theory of the public sphere as a part of democratic theory and of critical theory. And I think one has to really credit Habermas in effect with pretty much naming this category and calling attention to it in a way that was quite unprecedented. I think we all probably sensed earlier that there was some important affinity between democracy as an institutional regime and the practice of free, unrestricted argument, debate, expression. But that connection was made clear, actually, by Hannah Arendt earlier. But it was really Habermas that took this idea that one could conceptualize as an actual component of modern societies, a public sphere in the sense of a realm of discourse pervade, especially through the media of the epoch, whether it's print journalism or later the internet or visual media and so on, but that this sense that there was an area in which public opinion could be formed by means of unrestricted debate and discussion about the issues of the day. That's Habermas's idea. And of course, the idea goes along with the assumption that this public opinion formed through unrestricted argument and communication, horizontal communication, should become a kind of force, a power, he called it communicative power, that should have some real capacity to influence and perhaps under certain situations even constrain what public powers like states, formal democratic powers, can do, that they need to be responsive to and accountable to public opinion. And so it's this whole set of problems having to do with public opinion, the media, the relation between civil society and a democratic state. All of this is brought into visibility and becomes a problem for democratic theory through Habermas's early work on this. And that's really part of the essential background here. Now, this book was originally appeared in German. It didn't. It was belatedly translated into English long after many other works of Habermas, which were written after this one, but had already been translated. And it was sort of the growing interest in his thought in general that led people to go back to this book and translated belatedly in the late 1980s. I think it's 89, actually. There was quite an interesting and lively reception in the United States, especially of the public sphere book, and lots of interesting debates. Much of the most interesting material is collected in a volume that Craig Calhoun edited around the same time, called Habermas and the Public Sphere. And I think it's fair to say that this concept of the public sphere may turn out in the end to be Habermas's most influential idea. And I say that even though, you know, the various other more philosophical concepts like discourse theory and so on, or communicative action, might initially seem to be more significant. But the fact of the matter is that the concept of the public sphere that he developed has become a real category that informs sociology, media studies, history, political science, political philosophy. It's as if it's hard to imagine what it was like before we had this concept. And it may be the case that when all is said and done, decades and decades from now, it's this that Habermas will be most remembered for.
That's very interesting. In a minute, I'm going to ask you perhaps then to explain what your particular move is to transnationalize public sphere theory.
Right.
But before we do that, I actually have somewhat more of a kind of process question. But I think that one of the things that's most interesting and ultimately very lively about this text is its format, where there's a revised version of an essay you originally published in the late 2000s, then commentary by several scholars from different disciplines, and then your response. And so I was kind of wondering why you and then the editor, Kate Nash, came to put the book together in that particular form and what that process was like for you.
Right. Well, my piece, now my memory, and again, we have to check the dates, is that my piece originally appeared in 2007, if I'm not mistaken, in Theory, Culture, and Society, along with, as you say, quite a number of responses. And if memory serves, I visited a couple of times Goldsmiths College in London, where Kate Nash and Vicky Bell taught. They were the two guest editors of the special issue of Theory, Culture, and Society, where the piece appeared, and they were the ones who had drummed up all these responses. And we had all sorts of very intense and interesting discussions about my proposal to think in terms of a transnational public sphere instead of simply as was tacitly somehow pervaded by most of the discussion up to that point in terms of national public spheres. Anyway, it was one of these sort of contingencies. I was in close touch with John Thompson at the time, who has a longstanding interest in the theme of the public sphere and who was also the director of Polity Press. And he found the discussion at Goldsmiths very interesting, and he suggested that Polity would like to actually bring it out as a book. And then we began to think, you know, carefully about whether there were other people to invite and how exactly to structure it. And Kate really took the lead there and came up with a very intelligent and interesting group of comments, quite wide-ranging. And that was more than enough inspiration for me to try to think more deeply about the views that I had articulated originally, and whether they were, you know, could really withstand all the deep and probing questions and doubts that the other contributors raised. And I have to say that my experience of trying to rise to that occasion and answer those doubts and objections pushed me to think much more deeply than I had before about what really would count as a transnational form of democratic communication. And I should say that this whole set of questions about the transnational had already, for me, become very, very pressing in the light of work that I was doing about global injustice and related questions. And I was very preoccupied with relations between the North and the South and so on. So this was a great opportunity to try to you know, really push myself to think further, and also to correct what I now see was a major blind spot in my own earlier engagement with the concept of the public sphere, which goes back to the late 80s or early 90s, in which I, like Habermas and like many of the other people who participated in those exchanges, had tacitly, in an uncritical and unreflective way, assumed some sort of a closed national society as the correlate of the public sphere. And of course, in the later period, that whole question had become so contested that it was impossible to ignore anymore.
Right. And on that note, maybe we can kind of get into the heart of the content of the book some now, and maybe start there by asking you to perhaps give a brief overview of what changes in what you call in the book, in the essay, the post-national constellation that leads you or leads one to transnationalize public sphere theory, and perhaps what kind of background assumptions of public sphere theory are the need to be problematized.
Right. Well, as I said, there were really, I think, two fundamental, let's say, normative and practical ideas that were always central to my understanding of the public sphere theory that Habermas had developed. And one was the idea that it should be possible to distinguish, at least analytically, between legitimate public opinion that was formed through genuinely open, unrestricted processes of communication that were truly horizontal, in which you know, there was an easy entry into discussion, and the interlocutors could participate on a plane of at least relative equality. That would be distinguished from some kind of manipulated public sphere, you know, the fascist propaganda apparatus, or the advertising canned kind of public relations industry. So that was a very crucial idea. And the second crucial idea was this one I mentioned before, that public opinion generated in this, let's say, genuine way should also actually matter. It should become a genuine force. It should have some muscle. It should actually serve to influence and constrain the institutionalized powers in the world. What people think matters. And that's above and beyond the ballots that they cast. But, right, the sentiment that is formed through debate about the issues of the day should matter. And those two ideas were, for me, always what made the concept of the public sphere a genuine concept of critical theory, one that could be used to assess actually existing democracies and show where they fell short on either or both of those points. Now, the problem is that, as I said before, I think that it's in a way that's completely understandable. Habermas's original book, Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, was sort of tracing the emergence and the history of this public sphere, both as an ideal through thinkers like Kant and John Stuart Mill, but also as an actual institution that starts with a rather restricted public of literate, property-owning males sitting around and smoking cigars and coffee houses and having reading newspapers, to, you know, the larger idea that we have now with mass media and broader participation. His history of all of this, completely understandably, turns out in retrospect to be the history of what I would call the development of the sort of Westphalian model of democratic governance and democratic communication, meaning it was taken for granted that we already knew what the political community was, what its boundaries were, who counted as a member, and therefore who was entitled to participate, who had a right to be heard on equal terms, and so on. We tacitly assumed that we knew who the public was, namely, something like the adult citizenry or the adult population of an already constituted bounded community. And tacitly in this era, that meant in most cases something like a nation state that already had a language, a shared language of communication, that already had a state, which was the power to whom the communication was addressed, the power that the communication was supposed to be reflecting on and holding accountable. It already had a national media, a national press in the early days. I suppose in the 20th century, it would have been a national broadcasting system and so on. And very important, already had something like a national economy, because as it turns out in Habermas's account, the emergence of the public sphere is tied very closely to the idea that you have economies that are nationally bounded, that states at various times have to manage and steer to avoid or mitigate crises, that the original bourgeois members of the public have a great interest as property owners in paying attention to. It turns out a great deal of the substance of public sphere discussion in the Habermasian model was assumed to be the national economy steered by the national state, and this was all to be discussed in the national language through the national media and by the national citizenry, or at least that part of it that was considered the active literate citizenry. And once you sort of fast forward to our century, it just becomes very clear how that very neat mapping and lining up of all these things around the national frame just doesn't hold anymore. We have so many, let's say, discussion subjects that concern trans-border problems. Just think of climate change as one of the most obvious. We have diasporic language groups that maintain an active set of communicative institutions that don't that again cross borders. We have polities that don't share a language. We have many cases in which the problems do not line up nationally. The discussions are not national. The whole question of language, the whole question of the medium of communication is increasingly transnational, and participation doesn't neatly line up with formal citizenship either. And certainly the whole idea of a national economy that is somehow bounded and effectively steered by a given state we need only look at the headlines and what's going on in Greece and the EU or whatever to see how under what we call globalization today or financialization, this assumption too has gone by the boards. So it seemed to me that there were a whole set of assumptions built into the Habermasian model that no longer held. And once you took stock of that, then it looked like the whole idea of the public sphere could come unglued, because it was no longer clear, at least to me, what it would mean to distinguish legitimate public opinion from illegitimate or manufactured public opinion. You didn't have shared citizenship to sort of underwrite the parity of the interlocutors anymore. No longer clear what it would mean for public opinion to become an effective force when on so many issues we have trouble even identifying who the addressee of the opinion is. When we debate climate change, we know very well that this is not a problem that any state, even a very powerful state like the U.S., can solve unilaterally. So who exactly are we directing our our communication to, in the sense of a public power whom we want to act in our name? All of these sort of fundamental points that made it a critical theory are in danger, I think, of collapsing or becoming very problematic once we take into account the extent to which the Westphalian framing of public sphere theory is not adequate in our time.
And I think it would be difficult for me to kind of undersell to the audience how important the fact that this really is a critical theory of the public sphere grounded in the Frankfurt School is for this project, and that I think one of the most important aspects of the book is your emphasis on both kind of attending to the imminent current historical situation while also looking beyond it for emancipatory possibilities. So I'm wondering if you could perhaps talk a bit about what that particular perspective of the Frankfurt School of critical theory brings to rethinking public sphere theory on a transnational scale.
Right. Now, this is absolutely central. You could, if you want, you could think of this as a certain variant of left Hegelianism. That is, instead of a freestanding normative critique of the sort that Hegel famously objected to on the part of Kant as a mere ought, as opposed to that, the project is to try to understand how the norms that we use for critique are imminent, have arisen from within the historical context to which they then become applied and used as a critical standard. So the norms are supposed to have be simultaneously imminent within the form of life, have some real traction through history, through the way in which they've emerged and the society has developed, but also simultaneously be genuinely critical, have the capacity to take distance from the given, not to collapse into it, to reflect on it and to condemn it. But again, not as a mere ought, as Hegel would say, but by virtue of genuinely imminent possibilities for transcendence. That's the trick. It's not an easy circle to square, but that's the sort of, I think, the strategy that is fundamental to much of Frankfurt School thought, certainly to at least this strand of Habermas's thought. And it's the approach that has always been central for me. So if we think that today that all of the major parameters of what didn't make up the Habermasian concept of the public sphere are somehow out of line with one another, don't line up, don't map onto this sort of one clearly defined bounded unit, the territorial state, then we have to wonder, sort of what we're doing here when we use public sphere theory. One option, which is in, I think, probably very standard or widespread in media studies and communication studies, is to just treat the concept of the public sphere as a straightforward empirical category, and then to study, how who reads what newspapers and what their reactions are, and so on and so forth, without having this, this critical aim of trying to see the ways in which really existing democracy is blocked in our realizing itself in a full way in our context. Another strategy would be the opposite one, to sort of make it just sort of turn it into more like a freestanding normative category, and let's say condemn the democratic deficits from some external standpoint. And I think as a critical theorist, one doesn't want to do either of those two things, but find some kind of a third way that holds, to use the famous phrase Habermas developed later, to hold the tension between fact and norm together in such a way that you generate some critical traction. And that's what the problem I posed in the 2007 essay, Transnationalizing the Public Sphere. And I felt, as I read the contributions to the volume that we're talking about now, the Polity Press volume, I felt that there was many thoughtful and interesting points raised by all of the contributors, truly, but that there was a tendency on the part of several of them to kind of lose this distinctive left Hegelian idea of critique as simultaneously imminent and capable of transcending. And in my response, I tried to show how, to my thinking, a number of the contributors fell sort of off that that difficult path onto either a more empirical or a more freestanding normative approach. And of course, that really simply shows how difficult the left Hegelian path is, but nevertheless, to me, very much worth the effort.
Now, given that critical perspective, perhaps we can kind of get into two of the main areas in which you find it necessary to rethink public sphere theory, and perhaps we can take these in turn. First of all, in terms of the normative legitimacy of a transnational public sphere. Here, can you maybe talk a little bit about the importance of the question of inclusion, of who's going to count as an interlocutor, and how this question of who counts, and also the question of who is the addressee, which we'll get into in a second with the political efficacy question, but then what kind of changes from more traditional criteria for inclusion need to be undergone?
Well, I mean, the sort of the Habermasian formula was not just in public sphere theory, but in his discourse theory as well, was that all affected should have the chance to participate in discourse, or in this case, public communication about a given issue, all with a stake, you could say, in the outcome. And he used this phrase, all affected. And that was very much my original idea. There might have been a time historically when it seemed plausible to think that, as John Rawls did, that it was the sort of framework of the constitutional state that, in a way, was the most important determinant of effectiveness, and that if you used the boundaries of state citizenship as a proxy for effectiveness, you could, you know, more or less make it fly. In reality, even at the height of, let's say, the democratic welfare state in the, or the 19th century nation state, for that matter, even then, formal citizenship has never been a perfect or even a very good proxy for effectiveness. We only have to think about the history of colonialism and imperialism and so on to see how exclusionary, let's say, that approach turned out to be. And but yet somehow the national frame had such a Westphalian frame, I should say, had such a hold over the political imagination that people, political philosophers and politicians and many people, unless they happen to be on the very short end of the stick as a subject colonial population, for example, somehow were able to overlook this and still think that the citizenry that was a good enough match. But today, I think it's fair to say that there are many people who are who take a nationalist view and want to defend the national frame, but it doesn't go without saying they have to actually make the argument, because there's enough, sense of a non-fit on so many issues. So I think that my first thought was that we had to really take up affectedness as a category in its own right, and not, try to do it through the proxy of citizenship. I have to say that I started to think much more about this question of affectedness, and I began to worry that it was a little too amorphous. This whole problem of the butterfly effect, everyone is affected by everything and so on, and that it wasn't specifying enough what kind of affectedness really mattered. Actually, after I had already written the first essay in 2007, Transnationalizing the Public Sphere, later my thinking had continued. And I came upon the idea that I called the all-subjected principle, as opposed to the all-affected principle, meaning that everybody whose interaction is governed by rulemaking bodies of whatever kind in a given type of interaction was sort of subject to a governing authority, a governance structure that had enough of the properties that, say, states have as governance authorities, that to generate the same kind of, significant standing that you wanted for as a criterion. So not just somehow being randomly affected any old which way, but being subject to coercive authority of various rulemaking bodies. And then what I liked about this phrase, all subjected, is that it sort of gives you the old idea. It's rhetorically powerful. It gives you this sense that, where we were subjects, now we have to become citizens. And that's such a powerful historical trope in the history of democratization. It struck me that the next step now is all the ways in which even we in powerful states like the U.S. Are subject to so many other rulemaking bodies that in relation to which we don't currently have citizen rights, but are really subjects in the old sense. Anyway, so I started to play with this idea that there might be an all-subjected principle. And that sort of was how I handled the normative aspect of legitimacy and illegitimacy.
Right. So now if we kind of look to one of the other important aspects of a public sphere theory, that in terms of political efficacy, how was that question of efficacy kind of traditionally phrased or posed in public sphere theory? And how does it come to be transformed when we move to think transnationally?
Well, this is another very difficult question, and again, it's partly an issue of sort of retrospective understanding. With hindsight, it's possible to see that when we all were taking for granted the Westphalian framing of these questions, we were assuming that the public power to whom public communication was addressed, namely this national territorial state, actually had the capability to deal with the problem about which the public was addressing them. So in that, go back to that example of the steering the national economy, there was an assumption that there was a national economy and that the state had the requisite capability to actually assure a relative level of employment, growth, you know, infrastructure and all the things that we expected a modern state to do to sort of keep economic life afloat. And so that was one thing. We assumed that there was adequate public capacity at the institutional level to deal with the problems. And we also assumed that, and I think this was the second thing, was the focus of much of the earlier discussion in the 80s and 90s, we assumed that there were no blockages, that public opinion could actually get to the state and influence it, that there weren't all sorts of lobbying apparatuses and humongous sedimentations of private power, of concentrations of wealth, and so on, that could outgun public opinion, so to speak, and capture the state. So there had to be some sort of channel through which public opinion could be translated into public will and into state action. And you can see how that idea hooked up with very familiar Frankfurt School themes about, you know, manipulated public opinion, manufacturing of consent, all of that kind of stuff. Now, when we fast forward to the present, that second point about public opinion getting through, there being able to get translated into political will and public action, that remains a concern, I think, everywhere, pretty much. And then to understand that, we really need to talk more about the form of capitalism that we are living in at the present, and the concentrations of private wealth and so on. Multinational corporations, global finance, all of this. But what caught my attention even more than that was the point about public capacity. I think, and my thinking has developed on this point much further than appears in the book we're talking about now. I think we can really see that there's been a very significant hollowing out of public capacity. A lot of it has to do with the role that finance and investors, and above all creditors, it really has a lot to do with debt, have assumed in a global and transnational way as being the ultimate arbiters of what states or even a transnational entity like the European Union, what public power is allowed to do. When will the bond markets go crazy and say, no, we're dumping your currency and you can't do that? I think there's that this whole question of capacity is really significant today. And especially, again, I keep going back to global warming, but there are many other issues that are just by their very nature inherently larger than the scope, the jurisdiction of any state, even the largest and most powerful. So for many, many of our problems, both because of questions of scale, as in climate, and because of, let's say, runaway private power like global finance, we don't at the moment have confidence that the powers that are supposed to be public, that are our public opinion formed in public spheres is supposed to be holding accountable. We don't have faith often that they are actually even could, if they wanted to, deal with many of our most pressing problems. So this is a deeply troubling issue. The problem is our public spheres are not transnational enough to deal with the scope of the problem, but neither are our public powers. Let's say, have significant, sufficient heft or reach to deal with some of these problems. problems. And there are, you know, many, many examples I think we could give today. But that's the general idea.
Right. Now, I'd really like to impress upon the listeners that, I mean, all of the essays in this volume responding to your original essay and then your reply at the end are incredibly rich and well worth going into in depth. But so I don't monopolize all of your time, Nancy. I'd like to maybe just pick one and kind of ask you to talk a little bit about your response, specifically here to Kimberly Hutchings' chapter in the book. And in kind of the course of responding to her chapter, which is critiquing and thinking through the original article from the perspective of post-colonial theory, in your reply, you make a distinction that I find both very fascinating and incredibly important between what you call formal subjective conditions and then the contents of subjectivity. So could you perhaps explain to us some of what that distinction entails and why that distinction is important for transnational public sphere theory?
Yes. Well, I'm very glad that this is the essay you chose to focus on, because I think it's a very, very rich and profound paper, that of Kimberly Hutchings. And basically, she goes back to a part of Habermas's original book, Structural Theory of the Public Sphere, that people haven't paid enough attention to. And she asked, what about the sort of historical preconditions that enabled people to think of themselves as members of a public in the first place, and to, let's say, imagine themselves as fellow members of a public engaged in these discussions. And she suggests that in Habermas's case, many of these assumptions that permitted that stance of, or that ability to imagine oneself as a member of the public, were really tied up with being on the, let's say, the winning end of colonialism, of having all sorts of confidence that you had a state that would and should protect you, at least in theory, that you, as I say, as it said before, that you had the sense of being of agency in relation to history, and of it being even conceivable that through achieving democratic rights, you had a public power that you could, make the servant, in a sense, of your jointly elaborated public will. Now, when you try to, and Hutchings thinks that I went much too quickly in thinking about what's involved in transnationalizing the public sphere today, I ran too quickly over all of this, and that if you take it seriously, then you have to have very severe doubts about whether the whole project of public sphere participation as an intrinsic component of a democratic self-determination was not already a Eurocentric project, and that these assumptions, she thinks, were so foreign, let's say so utopian, to subjects of the British Crown in India, or of the U.S. in the Philippines, or you name it, throughout the world, that this imaginary doesn't have the same kind of resonance for post-colonial subjects today, and that there would be a certain skepticism, a lack of faith in being able to ever participate on a par with ex-colonial masters in, debate on terms of parity on the shared transnational and global issues of the day. And I do think that there was a level of but basically my strategy, as you just suggested, was to say she's right to try to probe this question of what are the subjective preconditions for being able to think of oneself as a member of a public, but that there we should distinguish between the idea of being having sort of historically oriented to problems that are thrown up that require intervention, the idea of, and not just, fatality, whatever happens, the idea of collective agency through some kind of a political process and use of public power to solve shared problems. I mean, all of these notions, I think, are part of those formal preconditions. And I think that they are today widely shared, even by those, let's say, various, let's say, transnational movements that reject the whole existing map of states as they're drawn, supporters of a caliphate, for example. I think that these assumptions of agency, collective will, construction of powers on that basis, these seem to me to be quite widely diffused wherever they originated. And whether they truly originated only in the West is not even clear to me. But wherever they originated, I think that those formal preconditions for publicity are widespread. But it is absolutely true that people have very different narratives, so that there's a tendency in the global North to think we used to have a more robust form of democracy. We used to have public spheres where we really knew who the public powers were, our states, where our states really could solve our problems and so on. And we are losing that. And so we get a narrative of decline informed by the idea, what do we have to do to get it back? Let's scale up or whatever else, we have to do. Now, Hutchings rightly says that narrative doesn't play for really a tremendous, perhaps a majority of the world's population that never felt it had had what we think we've had and are lost. And so for whom the narrative is sort of like, oh yeah, just another chapter in the long story of disempowerment, subjection to global and foreign powers, and so on and so forth. So you can see that it would be very crucial for a critical theory of the public sphere that's trying to think transnationally not to falsely universalize the narrative, the sort of sense of historicity and substantive temporality that is in actual fact specific, geographically and historically specific to one portion of the population that should be involved. And that's what I was trying to get at with Hutchings. I wanted to say, yes, she's right that as we try to develop public sphere theory on a more transnational basis and or democratic theory in general, we have to be careful not to universalize European or Euro-American historical sensibility. But it doesn't follow that the whole project of public sphere theory is somehow Eurocentric in a way that is sort of irremediable. And, you know, because it does seem to me that there is interest and sensibility and all of these, what I call these formal subjective preconditions, are quite widely shared. The issue is the substantive narratives that we tell. And I use the example of, I keep coming back to this, you can see what's on my mind, climate change negotiations, right. You know, you have a very interesting divide between a kind of presentist view that says, look at what the percentages of where carbon emissions are coming from now, and look at China, and look at Brazil, and look at how much they're doing, and a viewpoint that wants to look historically and say, yeah, but we're new in this game, and don't you see, you guys have been doing this for 200 years, and we have to take that into account when we think about how to allocate the costs and burdens and so on of saving the planet. That would be an example where you've got different narratives, different sense of what the relevance of history is or isn't, different notions even of time and temporality, and yet no trouble at all of coming together and having an actual argument about it. There may be trouble of reaching an agreement about it, but there's no trouble having an argument about it where everybody knows exactly what the others are saying and what the stakes are.
Right. I think this is another instance where kind of this book, or even especially here in your reply, you kind of carry out or enact that critical theory method quite effectively, and holding on to both this need to not overgeneralize or not universalize, while still not, you know, throwing out public sphere theory along the way. I'm wondering, perhaps now as the interview's about to come to a close, if you'd like to comment at all on the book in relation to events since its publication. Of course, I'm kind of thinking, and you mentioned it earlier, as I was reading the book this weekend, you know, with my eye on what was going on in Greece and the referendum vote. So I wonder if you'd like to comment at all about that, or other kind of current things that are going on. You've mentioned climate negotiations, and there's a number of other potential issues here.
Right. Like you, I've been riveted by the unfolding events having to do with Greece and the Eurozone and so on. And it is quite a remarkable drama that a critical theory of the public sphere could, I think, do much to illuminate. But one thing I have to say, I think the listeners should, I want to just make it clear to the listeners that the public sphere theory is one element of a critical theory. It's not the whole of a critical theory. And it's one element of democratic theory, not the whole of it. So when it's used as part of a critical theory, one wants to look at, have a sort of a institutional analysis as well as an analysis of how discourse and debate is organized, how public power is organized, how private power is deployed, and so on. I mean, this is all aimed at giving us a sort of picture of what's happening and the ways in which democratic aspirations and other aspirations are systematically blocked for non-accidental reasons having to do with the deep structure of the social formation. So having said that, here we have the Greek electorate giving us a resounding, larger, I think, than expected, in rejection of the austerity policies of the Troika. And that is, you know, this is one of these moments where public opinion has been forming and lots of debate and so on, and then crystallizes in it's an unusually clear moment where you really have a snapshot of what how the public thinks about this at one moment. But this is a national public. And at the same time, you have public opinion in other parts of the Eurozone that is quite different. I am very struck by conversations I have with German friends whom I think of as leftists or at least social democrats, for whom the Greeks are a little bit like the welfare queens that used to be so castigated in the United States. They evade their taxes. They don't work very hard. They retire too early, et cetera, et cetera. All these ways in which they're not proper, upstanding, deserving citizens. They don't pay back their debts and so on. So, you know, you got a whole different kind of public opinion that, to my ears at least, has a somewhat racialized resonance or echo. It's, as I say, it reminds me a great deal of welfare queen talk in the U.S. Not so long ago. So there's that. Then you have this sense of, and here I would recommend the really remarkable writings of Wolfgang Streeck, mm-hmm. especially Buying Time, now available in English, Gekaufte Zeit, as to the sort of, he has this argument about the two peoples. Yeah, on the one hand, there are electorates and members of the public in the classic democratic sense, but then there are, and it's all, you have to put this in quote, what the markets say, meaning the rating agencies, the bondholders, and so on. And this is like a dual power situation. Well, maybe not really, because the markets, quote unquote, meaning the bond markets especially, they are the real sovereigns increasingly, and they say what policies are can be even on the table and which are just off the table. So this is a whole, you've got, you know, competing public opinions within the EU and elsewhere. You've got the actual, let's say, highly dysfunctional governance structure of the EU. And here we could talk about all of those, you know, monetary integration in advance of genuine political integration and so on, all those imbalances. And then you've got this whole problem of the capital strike, so to speak, the investor strike, which is, you know, on a completely different level, which is just saying, we don't care about public opinion. We speak in another currency, right? It's the currency of interest rates and bond ratings and so on. And that's the currency that matters as opposed to referenda and you know. So I would say that I've only begun to unpack this, but one could go on and on. But I believe that this whole question of public opinion, national versus transnational versus you know, the non-discursive forms of power that are wielded, all of this is really ripe for analysis by means of the kind of critical theory, including public sphere theory, that we owe, in part at least, to Jürgen Habermas.
Thank you. So I was hoping we could perhaps conclude by you telling us a little about what you're currently working on.
Oh, okay. I'm really working on the problem of capitalism. And capitalism was always, in one way or another, the sort of, background of almost everything I've done, and it becomes more or less explicit at different moments. And again, it's very important that the history of public sphere theory in Habermas and in the subsequent debates and so on is a theory of democracy and its limits within capitalist modernity. That's part of the whole story here. But anyway, I feel that the whole question of capitalism today deserves a more frontal engagement, theoretically and politically. And I've been trying to develop a way of thinking about capitalism that owes something to Marx and to Polanyi, for that matter, mm-hmm. but that is that is concerned with situating the capitalist economy that Marxists traditionally focus on in relation to what I think of as its background conditions of possibility that are themselves not economic in the first instance, but that are essential for a capitalist economy to function. And one of these is the sort of taking up all the important feminist thought about social reproduction as an indispensable precondition for capitalist commodity production. So all the forms of unwaged labor that forms the human subjects that become laborers and that in general create, maintain social bonds that are the necessary social background. Also the ecological, so the climate change thing again comes up, mm-hmm. the assumption of a sustainable background ecosystem that can supply the material inputs, the energy inputs that can serve as a sink for absorbing the waste and sustain life. All of this has been an absolutely necessary background condition for a capitalist economy. And then finally, the third one, which in a sense we've already been talking about here for the last hour, public power as an indispensable background condition for a private market economy. And all the ways in which the capitalist economy depends upon public powers in terms of legal frameworks, in terms of democratic legitimacy conditions, in terms of repressive forces and sustaining a money supply, and so on and so forth. And I'm sort of thinking that today there is a severe potential for a very serious crisis of capitalism, not simply in the sense of severe economic strains, bursting bubbles and crashes and depressions and, you know, stagnation and so on and so forth, but also in relation between this sort of foreground economy and its background conditions. I think there's a sense in which the economy has become unmoored. This is a sort of quasi-Polanyian point vis-a-vis social reproduction, ecology, public power, and is starting to cannibalize and eat up its own background conditions of possibility. And so I'm trying to think about this whole problem of a crisis of capitalism in relation to ecology, social reproduction, and public power. And certainly public sphere theory remains a one crucial element for thinking this through.
All right, well, we will look forward and hopefully have you back on the podcast at some point in the future as you begin to work through those ideas. So Nancy Fraser, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books in Global Ethics and Politics podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.